Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Friday, February the 9th, and it's News Desk from Guardian Unlimited with me, John Dennis. Thanks to Tim Mabey for hosting yesterday's podcast while I was busy celebrating the birthday of one of our regular listeners, the lovely Mrs. Dennis. Today, new technology can read people's minds. The scientists who've invented it have called for an ethical debate. The outbreak of bird flu on a turkey processing plant in Suffolk has spread, and the government and the firm that owns the plant says there is a link between infected birds in Britain and in Hungary. Barack Obama's about to announce that he will stand in the race to be the next US president. You'll hear why Gary Young thinks Obama appeals to many American voters. And also today, fears of a new Cold War between Washington and Moscow as Russia unveils a big increase in military spending. And John Ronson investigates junk mail. Why should some people get more of it than others? Ross Taylor's a solicited delivery here in the pod with some other stuff from today's papers. Neuroscientists in Germany and in London and Oxford have developed a scanner that can look deep inside someone's brain and read their intentions. One of the scientists says it's like shining a torch around looking for writing on the wall. I asked our science correspondent Ian Sample to tell us how it's possible to read someone's thoughts before they act.
You can identify a part of the brain. It's called the medial prefrontal cortex, where the information of intentions is held. And what they've done is they basically looked for signatures of brain activity between someone's intention to, in this case, add a couple of numbers or subtract them. And they found distinct signatures, and you can give them a brain scan beforehand and say, this is what you intend to do.
Scientists have tried for a long time to find ways to eavesdrop on people's thoughts. How is this technique different from previous lie detectors and so on?
Well, what's most interesting about this one is, for the first time, it means that people have been able to use a scan, in this case an fMRI scan, to look at someone's intention to do something before they do it. And the nitty-gritty of looking at a brain and saying, I know that that activity means this particular thought, may never be possible, but it's far, far in the future if it is possible. But to be able to sort of look at this and say, we can tell which one of these two plans you're going to go with, which of these two actions you're going to make in the future, is a first.
I haven't seen Minority Report, but tell us how that film by Steven Spielberg is related to this.
Well, the idea in that film was that you had a way of, I won't go into the sort of the details of the film, but you had a way of knowing when a person somewhere was about to commit a crime. So the idea is that you go and apprehend them before they commit a crime. The neuroscientists themselves are getting very interested in this area, and they're saying that we really need to have an ethical debate about this, because some of their techniques are getting them, as this research is, you know, a very small step towards, it's getting them towards the point where they can say, well, you know, can you screen someone or look at someone's brain and say, we know that this person has criminal intentions or has tendencies towards violent behaviour? And that brings in lots and lots of ethical issues.
Because you might be able to be convicted on the basis of an intention to act, a thought, rather than the basis of anything you've actually done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it comes back to the whole sort of Julius Caesar sort of stories. I mean, it's a very tricky situation. I mean, you know, how applicable this will be is unknown at the moment. I mean, how many people are going to be able to go out there with big brain scanners and scan everybody and, you know, just before they're about to commit a crime and say, oh, we think you're about to commit a crime? I mean, there are huge practicality issues over this. The neuroscientists will say, well, look, if you plan to do something, that will be held in your brain somewhere, so we think we will be able to get at that in the future.
What about, you know, looking away from crime and surveillance and anti-terrorism, mm-hmm. interrogation and so on, what other possibilities are there for use of this technique?
What's probably a more near-term use of this stuff is to really refine ways of controlling computers and machinery using people's brains, because at the moment there are some rudimentary systems where you can tap into some brain activity and you can move a cursor around on a screen, say, pick out words, close, you know, windows, open files, things like that. But using this, the scientists are saying, well, maybe there'll be a system that will be able to read my mind and know that I want to open a word processor, open an email system, you know, go surfing on the internet. And instead of actually having to type every little letter of that command, it'll be a one level further ahead. And the same similar thing for mind-controlled prosthetic arms and wheelchairs and things like that. Instead of having to think very, very obscure thoughts to get these things to work and make it very tedious to the person, they may be able to make it a lot simpler.
Roz Taylor joins us. She's had a look at today's papers. Roz, it's pretty cold. There's a bit of snow about, and that's upset at least one reader of the Daily Telegraph.
At least one, yes. He says he didn't get his Daily Telegraph yesterday. He got it after September the 11th, July the 7th. He got it during both Gulf Wars, but this it didn't turn up. There can be no greater symbol of the decline of a once great nation, apparently. But more seriously, the Telegraph is pretty disgusted that apparently 1 million children didn't get to go to school yesterday. It says this is due to over-caution on health and safety by teachers.
News from Iraq and The Independent. Robert Fisk says that Sunni insurgents have offered a ceasefire.
Yes, this is a peculiar kind of ceasefire. It's not one that, as Fisk himself admits, the US could ever accept, because it demands a timetable for pullout. It demands conditions that the US can't possibly meet. And although it does have a certain significance, it's interesting that Sunnis are prepared to put something on the table, as it were. This is just one facet of the conflict. It doesn't. The offer doesn't even mention the Shias. So what they want is the US to go and to have a full-scale civil war with the Shias.
And the Times and the FT have got some interesting things to say about Iraqi refugees.
There's a very interesting report in the Times following a Sunni doctor who fled to Syria recently with his family because he wanted to stay alive, as he put it. And he's not the only one. According to the UN, around 2 million Iraqis have fled the country since the beginning of the since after the invasion, and about 1.8 million more are on the move inside the country. The FT has a very strongly worded leader about this. It says that the US and UK ought to rethink their refugee policies because, after all, we launched the invasion and we ought to decide how to help the people who are displaced as a result of it.
Now, Anna Nicole Smith, the former Playboy model who married a Texan billionaire, has died at only 39, Roz. What do the papers say about that?
There's quite a lot of sympathy for Anna Nicole Smith. She is a fairly tragic figure. The Mirror's Sue Carroll describes interviewing her about 5 or 6 years ago and describes her as an imposing figure, 6 foot and stunning, but completely out of it, unable to speak for the first 40 minutes of the interview. But she has a certain fascination here, and the Mirror and the Sun both lead with big pictures of her, looking just a little bit like Marilyn Monroe, who, of course, also died early. The Sun says she died of a drugs overdose, the other papers being more circumspect about the cause of her death.
The Bank of England... So I'm going to say that again. The Bank of England thinks that inflation is under control.
That's why it didn't raise interest rates yesterday, according to the FT, which has the inside track, it says, on what the Bank of England is thinking. That doesn't mean, of course, that they couldn't go up later this year, and most investors think they will. There was some good news, though, for people paying electricity and gas bills yesterday, because British Gas is going to cut bills and competitors will probably follow.
Now, some new research, possibly less than scientifically rigorous, I'd suggest, but nevertheless, women want successful men, but they don't want them to be too successful. Is that right?
I don't believe this personally. It's not a portrait I recognise. But anyway, yes, this is some research among female undergraduates or female students at British universities, and it suggests, it's a fairly small sample, I should warn you, John, that...
How dare you?
that women are keener on good-looking men who have an average kind of job, so something like, I don't know, a gardener, something like that, than good-looking men who are earning a lot of money in a very good job, because, the Telegraph speculates, they could be less faithful and they're too good to be true.
I'll be conducting my own research into this later on. Thanks very much, Roz.
You're a married man, John.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely I am. And thanks very much, Roz. And don't forget to read a review of the papers every day by subscribing to The Wrap. That's an email service with a review of the papers every day by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. The government's admitted that bird flu in Suffolk is more widespread than had been thought. The company that owns the plant that's been afflicted, Bernard Matthews, says birds did arrive in Britain from the plant in Hungary that was hit by the virus last month. John Vidal's The Guardian's environment editor.
Things have changed fairly dramatically in the last 24 hours. What we heard late yesterday evening was not only was there a trade in dead birds between Bernard Matthews' Hungary plant and the Suffolk one, which we did not know precisely before, we also found that the H5N1 had got not just into the one shed where they were doing the culling, but into three others as well. So this suggests that it was much more widespread than anybody knew before, and also the wild bird theory is now absolutely dead as a sick parrot.
What is the Hungary connection?
Bernard Matthews has got a vast complex there. He bought the biggest poultry farms in Western Europe down there back in 93, privatisation. He sends poultry around Europe from there. They always maintained there was no connection between the two factories at all, that they were independent bodies and so on and so forth. It emerged yesterday that 38 tonnes a week of dead birds is coming from Hungary to Suffolk. Now, these are, quote, semi-processed. Now, we don't know exactly what that means. The investigation, the DEFRA investigation, is now concentrating on those loads of birds coming over because they were roughly the same time and it was precisely the same strain of the H5N1. How it got there, we don't know. The big problem which we all have is that there is no overt connection between his Hungary plant and where in Hungary the previous outbreaks were.
How did it get from the processing plant at Bernard Matthews to the live birds?
That's the second great question. We don't know. I mean, all we can assume is that there has been a lapse of biosecurity. The processing plant is very close to where the live birds are, and it's quite possible that there is traffic between the two. I mean, it's conceivable that a birdie came into the processing plant and then took it into the thing. But I suspect that it would be probably found to be a lapse of biosecurity.
Bernard Matthews has changed its story over this. It had said that it was just an isolated case, and now it's admitted that the outbreak was more widespread. How bad is it for Bernard Matthews' business?
Well, I think it gets worse and worse. By maintaining that there was no connection right from the start, no connection whatever between his Hungary plant and his British plant, he now appears to be not being very honest. The question is, did he tell DEFRA and the government right from the start that there were these shipments? And we've had conflicting evidence on that today. We don't know precisely. He says yes. The government deputy chief vet this morning was less than certain. Sales of turkeys are now, Bernard Matthews turkeys, are probably down 9, 10, 15%. It's only going to get worse.
What's your view of the way the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs have handled this?
Pretty well to start with. I mean, there was a lot of questions about the delay in the notification and everything like that. But I think that's fairly understandable. It's a very complex disease. I mean, to verify that it is H5N1 as opposed to Newcastle's disease or some of the E. coli's is actually very difficult. It does take a couple of days at least to do that. Once they found out, then they were pretty upfront. I think that's when the problem started. If Bernard Matthews had actually told them that there was a trade between the two plants and they did not tell Parliament and they did not tell the European Union and the vets, then the trouble is with the big food industry that they have a long history of, because it's vast money, it's big money, of only telling you a little bit of the story, and it comes out. It always comes out, but it takes its time.
John, many thanks. Barack Obama's in Springfield, Illinois tomorrow, where he's expected to announce that he will be seeking the Democratic nomination as presidential candidate. Gary Young's written an article in which you can read in the Weekend magazine with Saturday's Guardian. He's been looking at the politician who's got what some commentators call the wow factor.
Barack Obama's political ascent has really been quite miraculous. He stood in 2000 against the former Black Panther Bobby Rush for a congressional seat and got completely trounced because black people thought he wasn't black enough, so to speak. So here's what happens. First of all, the sitting senator decides to resign. He is losing by double digits against his Democratic primary challenger, Burke Hall. Then Burke Hall's divorce records come out, and it shows allegations that he has beaten his wife. Barack Obama wins with 53% of the vote.
So that was a stroke of luck, really, rather than any political skill.
Absolutely, more luck than judgment. And worryingly for Hillary Clinton, most of his ascent has come through other people's marital difficulties. And then his Republican challenger, divorce records come out showing that he asked his wife to join him in sex parties so that other people could watch them having sex. Doesn't go down very well with the Republican base. He falls out. And Barack Obama wins with one of the largest majorities in the country. But even before a vote had been cast, he had become national news. And that was because he delivered the Democratic nomination speech at the Democratic Party convention in August. And he wowed the crowd with his personal story, with a kind of well-crafted speech that linked his personal story to his aspirations for the country.
Why is he attracting so much excitement? I mean, comparisons with John F. Kennedy, even.
There was a recent poll that showed that most Americans wish that George Bush would just go away. People don't like the way it's progressing, so they're looking for something new. They're looking for something different and some sense of uplift, which is a similar place to where they were in 1960, I think, when Kennedy was elected. And Kennedy, the first Catholic, there was some sense of, like, can America do this? Can we get over these kind of age-old prejudices? And Barack Obama represents, to some degree, something a bit new.
Where does he fit into what we know about racial politics in America?
His personal story is not a regular story. He was raised in Hawaii. His mum is originally from Kansas. She married a Kenyan at a time when interracial relationships, interracial marriage was illegal in many states. He goes to Indonesia to primary school. He comes back and is raised by these Midwestern white grandparents while his mum stays in Indonesia. So on all of these levels, he is something that people have never seen before, and he can attach himself to any experience, almost. Immigrant, Midwestern, single parent. He went to Harvard. He was the first black editor of Harvard Law Review. All of these things make him new and different. But racially, he's not African-American. His dad is Kenyan. He didn't rise up through slavery and segregation. He has no story about his grandparents under sharecropping. This makes him less threatening to many white Americans. Joe Biden's comments just last week, the first mainstream African-American candidate who's clean and articulate, here's a black guy that doesn't freak me out. Secondly, Obama was born in 61. He was 2 when King made his I Have a Dream speech. He was not forged in the civil rights movement and the civil rights moment. So he's part of a new generation. Deval Patrick is another one, the new governor of Massachusetts. Also Condoleezza Rice. A new generation of African-American leadership that doesn't rise through the church, which is where most of them have risen, and who wasn't forged in that kind of hot cauldron of civil rights era politics that would have been the case for Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and that generation.
Russia's announced a huge increase in military spending that's raised fears of a new confrontation between East and West. The Russian President Vladimir Putin's making a speech tomorrow in Munich, in which he's expected to attack America's plans to site part of its missile defence system in Eastern Europe. Luke Harding's in Moscow. I asked him what he thinks Putin's going to say tomorrow.
Putin, and indeed Russia, is very irritated by really what it regards as a kind of encroachment on its doorstep. The Bush administration is planning to site 2 missile interceptors, one in Poland and the other in the Czech Republic, and has said, I think rather disingenuously, that these are going to shoot down rogue Iranian missiles or rogue missiles from North Korea. But in fact, really, the Russians are saying, I think correctly, that this whole missile defense system in what used to be the Soviet bloc is clearly aimed at Moscow. And I think Putin's going to complain about this, essentially, and say that Russia will respond very robustly.
Well, tell us about this increase in Russian military spending.
Well, it's not small change. On Wednesday, Russia's rather hawkish defence minister, Sergei Ivanov, sort of set out his kind of shopping list to the parliament here. Russia's spending £97 billion over the next 8 years and is really overhauling most of its military infrastructure. There's going to be more intercontinental ballistic missiles. Russia's normally been buying 4. That's going to go up to 17. New nuclear submarines, 3 of those, possibly a fleet of aircraft carriers. And also, the whole early warning radar system is going to be revamped. The problem being that in the Soviet Union days, this was on the edge of the empire, and these countries are now falling into the orbit of the US, Moscow fears. So it's a lot of money over a long period. And the thing is that in the 90s, you know, Russia was broke, couldn't spend money on military hardware. But now, you know, the Russian state is rich and is spending lots and lots of money on missiles.
Because in 2002, Vladimir Putin and George Bush signed a treaty to cut nuclear weapons by 2/3 by 2012. Why have relations between Russia and America cooled so much since then?
There have been a series of disagreements. I mean, most of all over Iraq, of course. But there have been other sort of global crises where they've disagreed, recently over Kosovo, for example. And in the US, there have been concerns, as there have been, in Britain, over the kind of increasingly authoritarian direction that Mr. Putin appears to be leading Russia ahead of presidential elections here in March of next year. So the relationship has cooled. But I think from a Russian perspective, this latest decision by the Bush administration to site these missile sites in Eastern Europe, right on the borders of Russia, is seen as a kind of unnecessary kind of provocation, really, especially since the kind of the reasoning behind it is so obviously hollow. I mean, Iran doesn't have any ballistic nuclear missiles yet, but Russia has lots of them. So if you're installing a system to shoot these things down, clearly it's directed at Russia.
Luke, many thanks. British households get 3.4 billion unsolicited letters every year. That's up to 15 letters per household per week. But have you ever wondered why it's you that's forever being offered new loans and credit cards? Well, John Ronson has. He's carried out an investigation for Saturday's Guardian. And I asked John what he decided to do back in April last year.
I wanted to see whether or not junk mailers, particularly credit card junk mailers, were bombarding certain personality types with junk mail. Were they trying to pinpoint particular personality types? I wondered whether the posh person was getting more credit card junk mail than the crazy person. So what I decided to do was to devise an experiment where I'd create a number of personas, and each of my personas would sign up to various different mailing lists and never tick the box, you know, the box that says, I don't want my details being passed to a third party. And I wanted to see which of my personas would end up getting blasted with credit card junk mail.
Now tell us which personas you created.
Okay, well, they were called John, Paul, George, Ringo, Dave D, Dozy Beaky, Mick Titch, Willie Biff Happy, and Bernard, after Death of a Salesman. Paul Ronson was very high society. He only signed up to kind of posh mailing lists. Then there was Happy Ronson, who was completely ethical, was signing up to Body Shop, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and so on. Then there was George Ronson, who was a kind of twinkly-eyed older gentleman who was signing up for kind of nostalgia CDs in the back of the Daily Express. Then there was Titch Ronson, who was a venal pervert who was only interested in hardcore pornography, Nazi memorabilia, extreme martial arts like bare-knuckle boxing, and, you know, obsessive gambling.
Was your experiment a success? What did you actually find out?
Well, my experiment was a success in that one of my personalities got all the junk mail. So it proved to me that they are looking for certain personality types.
Are you going to tell us which of your personalities got the most junk mail?
No, because that will ruin it for readers. It's a great twist, though. But it offers a wonderful insight into the way these people work. It's not just the junk mailers, but the geodemographers, you know, these computer programs like Mosaic. Have you heard of these computer programs?
I hadn't until I read your article.
All the credit card companies use this thing called Mosaic, which separates every single household in Britain into a category. I was following a guy who committed suicide because he was out of his depth with credit cards. The category of his postcode was Happy Families, Families Making Good, which is kind of not very intelligent people. This is how the geodemographers see them. They own their own home, which gives them something to seize if they default on their credit card payment.
If any of our listeners are thinking that they seem to get more junk mail than other people, what does that tell them about themselves?
Well, it will tell them that they've been identified as a certain personality type by the credit card companies. And if you read my piece on Saturday, you'll know what personality type, and it might make you feel a little bit rotten about them.
That's John Ronson, and you can also find out which of John's personas got the most junk mail by reading that article in Saturday's Guardian Weekend magazine or at guardian.co.uk/weekend. Today's show is produced by Tim Mabey and Francesca Panetta. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.